We do count it a privilege to be here with you. I would also like to mention in this regard that we haven't arrived yet. And some of the things that we'll share with you are principles that we're still struggling with and working on. And I'm sure that you're all familiar with that. And, in fact, I thought it was kind of funny. This morning we were having a brunch and talking about part of the sessions, and we really got a little heated in our discussion. And I thought, well, here we are still learning. And so we are. One nice thing about when I go off to speak by myself instead of Joyce and our children being along is that I can speak as an expert. When they're along, they know the truth. But apart from that end of it, I personally always look forward to the time that Joyce and I get to go out together and co-speak and just share the things that God is teaching us together. Because we both understand, we know where we're at and the things we're struggling with, and we know that we're sharing not out of, always out of our successes, though God gives those, but sometimes out of our failures, and how God helps us in those to learn and grow in our love, marriage, family relationship together. So I did want to mention that to you in the beginning. A story told of a fellow who he and his wife had been married for 50 years, and apparently very successful marriage and well spoken of, highly thought of. So a reporter was interviewing him, thought it was a good human interest story, was interviewing him. So as he was interviewing him, he said, I understand that you've been married for 50 years and you really had a good marriage. Let me ask you a question. It's a little personal, but in all these years, have you ever considered divorce? The guy thought for a minute and said, well, no, never have. Never, ever considered divorce. Murder, yes, but divorce, no. Well, we'd like to take the first part of our time in this session together in talking about is there pizzazz or how to get pizzazz in your marriage. Are you fun to live with? Think about it. Are those, you know, those are really good questions. Well, you may, as you read the title, kind of evaluated yourself, your mate, and kind of thought, well, we're here, we're not here. You probably really formed some kind of an opinion as you even read the title. Well, what we'd like to do right now is to take about the next 3 or 4 minutes and have you pair up about three couples. You know, there are three of you here. Three couples, and take about 3 minutes and just talk about how do you get pizzazz in marriage? Or what is pizzazz? That may be a good question. You know, what is pizzazz? I'm not sure I know myself, so it would be a good time. And so we want to take you time right now, just jot down some of the things that you feel are pizzazz, and maybe one of you can kind of be delegated the spokesman for your group, and we're going to have, at the end of that time, you just share from the floor some of the things that you think our pizzazz in marriage. So now you're on your own for about 3 or 4 minutes. Just, you know, divide up into groups of about three couples. If it doesn't fit, we'll listen, and Joyce is going to be jotting these down just for our information. You may want to jot them down too. So, okay, let's hear it from the floor. Okay, surprises like breakfast in bed. All the women clapped. Okay.
I think he thought the men were going to have it in bed, and the women were going to turn it.
Someone else? All that time and you didn't come up with anything?
We came up with several different things.
Okay, enthusiasm and cheerfulness. Okay, open and full communication. Okay, communicating then gives you a chance to know what pleases your mate, where you can actually see that that does transpire. Okay, a sense of excitement. Okay, and goals to work toward. Very good. Someone else.
Thank you. romance. And also, I came with the backup for daily life.
Okay, honesty, creativity, romance, humor.
We had a deep interest in each other, and not getting into a rut, being real adventurous.
Okay.
Really not to lead others around us together.
Okay, having a real interest in each other, not getting in a rut. Okay, don't take each other for granted. Plan surprises. Take an interest in each other's interests. Okay, well, one more here.
We came up with honesty, integrity, and hard work, and through the whole thing, the unshakable belief in Jesus Christ.
Okay. Right. Yeah, the core of it, the unshakable faith in Christ. Okay, very good. One of those things is keeping your mate the most important person in your life.
When we start the game,
right, a good way to keep that other person, your mate, the most important is to read 1 Corinthians 13 and do it. Don't just read it, do it. Okay, well, let's go along here. Move along.
Actually, you've covered our day's message. We can now have coffee break. So.
Yeah, you made it easy for us. Well, actually, a person can have a good or successful marriage and really not have pizzazz in it or be fun to live with. A lot of these things depend on us as individuals and what we are looking for, what we expect out of life. So one of the important things we have to remember is that being uniquely different, that as we establish the basics of life together, that the working out of those things and the things that do put added interest are merely that, they're added. A person can have a good, successful marriage, and really, as a person looks at it, they think, that's a good marriage, and yet there's not pizzazz in it. Now, to most of us, say, well, we want the pizzazz, or some of it anyhow, and that's probably true. But we do need to recognize that the other exists and allow people the freedom of being themselves in their marriages and not trying to equate the goodness or badness of their marriage on where there's a lot of excitement or pizzazz, but on the quality of the marriage, first of all. Because unless the basics are established, so it is a successful marriage in the basic areas of life, the fun, the pizzazz, is going to become empty and meaningless, and a person will soon start shooting for that to find fulfillment, and it won't do it because it's momentary. It'll fade away. Now, when the basics are established and a person has a good working basis, then the fun, the pizzazz, really adds zest and life to a marriage. And we never want to forget that, because if we get them in reverse order, we're in trouble. Now, as we approach this realm then of the basics that God has established that we need to have to make our marriages go to begin with, one of the things that we need to consider is that life is always a changing thing. It's never static. And so we thought it would be good just to begin with an overview of marriage and life as we face it as couples. So, honey, would you take over?
Actually, we're going to cover about 50 years in 10 minutes. If someone were to have 50 years together, then their marriage would be going through some of these stages. It's great to get them written down, no matter which stage you're in now, because it helps you to know what's upcoming. You'll be writing these down one by one, so if you don't get them all to begin with, don't worry about it. We'll give them to you singly. How about that? One thing we neglected to say as we began, that Elvin and I have been through many of these stages, because in our three children, we have two older girls who are 25 and almost 24. One is married. I have a grandbaby who's 16, 17 months old. Then we have a caboose baby who's 7. So we relate with any of you. We can talk about grandparents, about grandkids, and show you pictures.
But we haven't retired yet.
Oh, that's right.
I'm retired, but not retired.
But many of these stages we can identify with personally. Now, the reason we talk about the courtship to wedding period is because it figures so greatly in some problems that come later on. And marriage is an intricate system of roles and needs and relationships and responsibilities, satisfactions, and they had to change. They have to move along as the situations change. So let's talk very quickly a little bit about each one of these and some of the developmental tasks that you would find in the different stages. And if you're going to call number one courtship and engagement up to the wedding, the prime theme of it would be from the song The King and I, Getting to Know You. It's an exploration and discovery days. Now, one of the problems with this, and it'll come up later on in the marriage if people don't recognize, is that it's a false, sometimes it can be a false discovery. That is, most courtship is carried on in leisure time. You put the best foot forward. They're not always the pressure situations. 90% of marriage is not leisure time, right? You're attracted by strength in the partner, and you sort of ignore the weakness and figure they'll disappear, or you can handle that, or they're really not that big anyway. Sharing common experiences, beginning to move from I to we. Remember that our song, our mountain, our whatever. Planned experiences, marvelous times. There's a practicing of communication, but often about surface things. There's determining what kind of family life and planning the wedding. Often it's just planning the wedding, not the marriage. It's just the wedding. It's giving time to the other, thinking of their needs first. What do you want to do? Oh, I don't care, sweetheart. What would you like to do? Oh, I really don't care. What would you like to do? And you fail to recognize that that probably will change later on. Proverbs 30, 18 and 19 impressed me with this, that there are things that are too wonderful, three things are too wonderful, four that I don't understand, the way of an eagle in the sky, a serpent on a rock, a ship in a sea, and a way with a man with a maid. Beautiful to see the courtship. Okay, then the next stage is the wedding to the first pregnancy. Two become one, or getting it together. Not because of common interests or personalities, but because God said that a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they two shall become one. Now, the working out of that is what the rest of the marriage is about. And in this particular stage, it's to form the basis of a whole new family apart from hers and his. It's now ours. And in early marriage, did you know that couples talk more to one another than at any other stage in their marriage? Early marriage. And it's the kind of communion that's so great. It's subjective. What do you think? And how do you feel? And plans and a lot of talk that's meaty, a comparison of ideas and likes and dislikes. And you do more together. You do dishes together even. You establish roles, that kind of thing. Now, of course, the actual business of living together can have some repercussions from the courtship days.
Someone said that actually during the dating days, the courtship days, where he talks and she listens, and on the honeymoon, she talks and he listens, and afterwards they both talk and the neighbors listen.
In this stage, adjusting can be the name of the game after a few weeks. Adjusting. It's love with its eyes open, and she really does squeeze the toothpaste in the middle and not on the end. And the weaknesses and the routine can cause disillusionment. And kids who are just fresh married don't realize that it's at this point they're really ready to begin to build a marriage. Then the third stage, parents of preschool children. This normally lasts just over 2 years. And you can imagine the terrific problems and adjustments that we face in our society today with so much premarital sex and babies born ahead and brides who are already pregnant. Now, no marriage remains static, and you just about think you're getting your role squared away as what you do and he does, and then kiddos come along and it all changes. And you're still working on that adjustment when you are beginning with parenting roles. And the children's needs for an intimate relationship with their parents means that the time, quantity of time, that a husband and wife would have together are necessarily cut down. It puts a strain physically. Mothers are tired, new mommies. Often there's an adjustment of schedules. It puts pressures financially sometimes. Sometimes hubbies are jealous. It's this period, though, that begins generating new life. And you pour a lot of your energy for the next few years now into maintaining history, if you will, by investing in the next generation. Now, these next stages can run together with babies coming along and school kids. And it's here that one of the problems, and you notice in most of these pictures, we've kept the couple together. These two people are together. The necessity of being partners throughout the whole stage. But one of the problems comes, if it becomes a problem, it's a hairy one, of over-investing in the children and under-investing in the marriage. It's a particular danger, I think, for women to begin to feed in and getting emotional needs satisfied by their children, particularly if their husbands are not meeting their needs. School is a very vital process that begins that day when you said goodbye to them permanently. Will culminate in the child leaving home and establishing families of their own. And it's at this age, that 6 to 12, that hubby is getting ahead in business. It's also years when the children are ripe for togetherness, 6 through 12. If mom and dad say it, at 6, it's probably so. After 12, you may not be quite that easy. They may not be quite that easy to persuade.
Yeah, 6, you can beat any guy in the neighborhood, and at 12, you don't challenge anybody, you know. With your kids. They think you're the world's greatest.
And studies show that average parents of school-age children talk together exactly half as much as they did in those early married days. And the problem is what they talk about becomes the talk of business partners. Johnny needs new shoes. Did you know there's a PTA meeting on Tuesday? Don't forget to pay the telephone bill. And that kid needs shoes again. You know, that whole kind of thing. Rather than taking the time for subjective exploring of feelings. This is the time to build on the family. We have 4 in our family, and we figure there's the... No, we have 5. There's the 5th member of the family called the Smith. And we take all the members and the family into consideration, or used to before our daughter was married. Okay, the next one, the pressure pot. Of being parents of adolescents, kids 13 through 18 or so. Busy, demanding, hectic days, they can be. There can be conflicts with the adolescents. Some go through more smoothly than others. Control over the child is challenged by him, maybe by the parents themselves. And parents have a tendency to relive their own teen years. And that can put added pressure. If they went through a rough time, did not feel accepted, and their child comes back with them, testing all that they do and all they say, it can add a tremendous feeling of insecurity. And isn't it interesting that every one of these stages of marriage, one partner may have more adjustments to make than the other. The sense of worth and adequacy can be threatened if there's not a good self-image, a good partnership with husband and wife. Because at this point, parents can come to the psychological impairment, if you will, of the 3 B's, balding, bulging, and bifocals. And here are these smartly attired, darling kids running around, and mother's home again. And they're going out. And there can be a jealousy from one parent to the child. And if the marriage has been faltering, if there's been too much investment in the kids by mom, too much time at the job by dad, not enough time together, then they can become emotionally independent of one another, if you will. Take each other for granted. The next stage, parents of children leaving home, are the emptying of the nest. Proverbs 14:4 says, where no oxen are, the crib is clean. And cheer up, Mom, there'll be a day when you won't have to pick up socks anymore. You won't have to say to your daughter, will you please straighten up your room? You'll be straightening it up all the time. I remember weeping when our daughter was married at the dining room table. The day after she was married, seating the leftover bridesmaids and people, seating every around, realizing there was still a person standing there. I don't know, where does she go? And I realized I'd left Laura's seat empty. I mean, she'd always sat there. So I cried, and then we seated the girl there. Aging parents can put a strain where a grandmother, grandfather may have to move in, may need to move in. It may cause another adjustment. It could be at this time that there are some unfulfilled dreams about your marriage that you figure are not going to get handled. You may not be the president of the company, men. That may cause a problem. For a wife, there can be a central loss of satisfaction for her work if she's invested everything in the basket of the kids, and the kids begin to leave home, and she's left without anything. It can really get to her. Did you know that in the early 20s, more women in the United States commit suicide in their 40s than any other?
Also, at this particular stage of life, the divorce rate, which is greatest in the first 3 years of marriage, or after the first 3 years of marriage, the second greatest stage is after 20 years of marriage.
In one interview, only 3% of women over 40 felt that their marriages were happy or that they had a fulfilling marriage at all. So we have to have basic skills in this one in relating. If you haven't done it all along, by the time you get to here, it gets a little shaky. Emptiness to retirement. Middle age is always about 5 years older than you are, whatever you are. If the identity that's been formed between a husband and a wife stays steady, stays solid and secure, and they've enjoyed one another, stayed in partnership all through the years, there can be the healthiest kind of a relationship here. Back again to more subjective talk. And the emotional independence, if it has stayed out of the marriage, this couple can relate very well in here again. There's a growing edge Godward that can be a real part of the marriage. New opportunities to enjoy each other, enjoy the grandkids, new careers perhaps, serving others. And then the last one, retirement to the death of one partner. And it could be that when mom went through an adjustment period when the kids left home, that dad's going to go through a little bit in retirement. He may feel that he's not so needed anymore. And it may be that mom doesn't necessarily like to have him around. She said, I married him for better or for worse, but not for lunch. And if couples have not planned for retirement, thought ahead, what are we going to do? What do we want to do? Retirement should be planned for, as should our home going, the partner.
There are three basic areas that we'd like to cover now in our time that build in the basics of a successful marriage. And with each one, we'll share with you some things that we feel that where pizzazz enters in. The first area has to do with knowledge and acceptance. It's the first main category we'll cover. The second has to do with communication. The third, consideration and sex. In this realm of knowledge and acceptance, one of the great reasons many marriages fail and many marriages are not successful, even if they seemingly are staying together, centers around this realm of knowledge. In Hosea 4:6, God says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. It doesn't say it's people who don't know him or don't belong to him, but my people. We fail to become knowledgeable. And I think that covers a gamut not only of scriptural knowledge, but knowledge about our mate as a person. The knowledge about the differences between male and female. To really know what is the makeup of a woman that is different primarily than the makeup of a man. And I think that's why God in 1 Peter 3:7, when he really lays it on the husbands, puts this word knowledge in. He says that husbands are to dwell with their wives according to knowledge. We've got to be knowledgeable about one another, what we're like, what our dreams and aspirations are, what those things are which fulfill us as an individual, as a person, what the things are that we would like to do, the things that we enjoy, as someone mentioned in while ago talking about pizzazz. Too often we tend to go along in the mundane and think that what we're doing is just the right thing without really being knowledgeable. So it's very important that we grow in knowledge and never maintain status quo. It's interesting that most of us really kind of would like to reach the realm where we're comfortable and secure and live in that. And think, well, boy, we're there now. Boy, let's just live in that. But life isn't that way. We're changing. We're never the same person. I'm not the same person today I was yesterday. I'm a day older, for one thing. Maybe a hair or two less, you know. But we're changing all the time. And in those changes, physically become emotional changes. Changes in the circumstances of life. Maybe our children have now reached a realm where they're no longer in the kindergarten. They're going to the elementary grades, and then they're leaving that in the junior high. And before long, they're dating, and then they're away to college, and before long, we're alone. Your life is always changing. And we have to be knowledgeable. Now is not the time to think, well, where are we now? What should we be doing now? If you don't know, you should find out, but we should be preparing ahead. You know, how do we help our kids when they're junior high? Should be talked about when they're in the elementary school grades. So life is growing and changing. We need to be knowledgeable. But in all that, we need to realize that there are three areas of acceptance that are vital. First of all is that God accepts us just the way we are. He made us that the way we are. He better accept us. He's responsible. But he does. He accepts us just the way we are. And to me, one of the most glorious verses in the Bible is Ephesians 1:6, which says, to the praise of the glory of his grace, wherein he has made us accepted in the beloved. In Christ, we have total acceptance. And God looks at us and he sees us. When we invite Christ into our life, he sees us in Christ. He doesn't see our sins and failures and all those things. Those are wiped out. He sees us accepted in the beloved. What a tremendous thing. And we have to recognize that we have this acceptance with God. Now, God may not always be pleased with some of the things that we do, but it never changes his acceptance of us as a person. You know, he so loved the world that he gave. We are acceptable to God. We have to see ourselves that way. That's the platform which everything else we do springs forth, that we have this acceptance with our Creator. But then we have to go on beyond that. We have to accept ourselves. You know, God made each one of us uniquely different. There are no two people here alike. There are no two people in the world alike. Even identical twins are not alike. There are things that are different about them. And God made us the way we are. Now, there are some things that we contribute to what we are that we can change. For example, one of the verses God gave me for this year was a very interesting one. It's Philippians 3:19. And part of it says, whose God is their appetite. Well, I can control that 20 pounds extra weight my doctor tells me I should lose. So I do have some responsibility, but I can't change the fact that I'm only 5 feet 6 inches tall. I'm that way by the grace of God. That's just the way I am. And nothing I can do. I can wear platform heels, I suppose. That's sort of a false thing, but I have to come to the realm where I accept myself the way I am, the way God made me, and be pleased with it. And an amazing thing is that in life, as we accept things that could be disappointments, frustrations, or lead to bitternesses, things that are often come into our life that are hard, the way we treat them is going to determine us, our growth as an individual. So it's been said that the way we meet these things will determine whether they become stepping stones or stumbling blocks. And so I can accept the fact that I am this way and utilize it. Let me give you an example. I mentioned that I like sports. Maybe I do that with the fellows, but I like sports, and basketball happens to be one of the games I have played the most. Well, I'm really not very tall for basketball. In fact, I'm kind of at the other extreme. And I used to really feel bad about that. If I could just have been 6 feet tall, I could do a lot more. But I've learned that was a real blessing. It wasn't for years that I realized that. Because I learned to do things that the average guy who's 6 feet tall, 6'3", doesn't have to worry about. You know, I can shoot with either hand. I can dribble either way. I can drive. I can shoot from out. And I'm teaching our son to do the same thing. He's going to have the advantage, the fact that I'm small, in basketball. So we take those things and we find that, hey, man, I'm all right the way I am. I'm okay. God made me that way. And we have to come to that place of self-acceptance. And God gives us the clue to that when he says that we are to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. We're to love ourselves. And if I don't love myself, then I'm hating something that God loves. You know, it's always safe to love what God loves. And he loves me, and therefore I can love me. And should. Because from that self-acceptance, that self-love, springs my love, not only for my neighbor, as it says in Matthew 22:37, but also even a deeper love, which is a third love that comes in. And that's the ability to love my wife and accept her as she is. Because when I accept myself as I am, then I can accept her as she is. And so in that great chapter, the husbands and wives of Ephesians 5, the Lord comes along and the highest type of human love that's possible, God says, I should have for my wife, I have to love my wife as I love myself, and also as Christ loved the church. The highest type of love that can exist upon earth is that love of Christ that he gives us that we can love our mates. And so when we love them, we accept them. And so together we work on this acceptability. Well, as we grow in this relationship then, we soon learn that God made us, and in our marriage, he made each one of us so that we can fulfill and fit together, or as it were, complement one another. So, honey, would you come and just talk about some of this area of complementing one another?
It's so easy to state that a man is always like this, or a woman is always like that. And this is a man's role, and this is a woman's role. But the Bible is not all that cut and dried. There are a few things that the Bible states are clearly the role of a wife. A mother, to be a mother. That's just up to us, gal. We'd like to change that once in a while, but that's the way it is. I bear children. Elvin does not. There are some specific things that the Scripture gives, but there are ways that we can have insight into what we are like by seeing the instructions that God gives to husbands and wives and then learn from them. I'd like to suggest for a moment for husbands, in order to know your wives, if you take a peek, you needn't turn to it, but write down some things. Ephesians 5, that Elvin's already referred to, mentions that a husband is to love his wife. Do you know why you're to love her? Because she needs lots of love. Women need love. We are, by our very nature, emotional. And we need to be satisfied knowing that we're loved. We need to know that we're not only loved, but we need to feel that we are loved. Fellows, have you thought of the scripture, where is it? Is a man thinketh in his heart, so is he?
Proverbs 23:7.
I have my own concordance that walks with me. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. You know, that's true for a wife. If she thinks she is, she is. And it's a wise man who will make his wife know that she's lovable as well as loved. Because as you love her, and you get her thinking that she's lovable and lovely and loving, she'll become that. You make of her that which she thinks of herself. It gives her a sense of security. Elvin and I in Bible studies, and whenever we do a Bible study talking about the foundations of marriage, often we start out with a small group and have them recite what they think are the various needs. Why do husbands get married? What's the driving impulse toward marriage? What's the impulse for a woman toward marriage? With rare exceptions, women will always list security. And men list the reason they marry primarily for sexual satisfaction. Many other things. The things are common for reasons for marriage. But our driving impulse, a wife needs to feel secure. She needs to be loved as being part of you. That's really something. A husband is to love his wife as being indeed himself. It doesn't mean you're to love her and care for her like you care for yourself. That is, make sure she has plenty of food and clothes and a house, a roof over her head. It means you're to love her as being indeed yourself. She's you. She is you. And again, that gives her an assurance of security, of being protected and cared for. And then he's to give himself for her as Christ gave himself for the church. He provided leadership. Because women need leadership. We do not need authoritarian bondage type to put us into a bondage of a slave, but we need leadership. And a woman, a wife can respect her husband who will give strong leadership. Whenever I speak at a women's conference and ask for questions to be handled, inevitably there will be two or three that always come up. And the primary one is, how can I work somehow in our marriage so that my husband will be the spiritual head? And if you give yourself, men, for your wives, as Christ did the church, who he washed her, he cleansed her by his washing of his word. You see, I know men who can club their wives with the word, but all to wash her and to cleanse her. Do you know the word that well, men, that you can wash her with the word, refresh her spirit? You see, it sets her apart, makes her feel special. I was interested in the verse in 2 Timothy 4:7, directed to men. It says that they're to train themselves in godliness. That bodily training is of some value. Your workouts, your running, all of that is great. But godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and in the life to come. Men, your godliness will give your wife a headship in her home that she longs for. It gives her emotional support, makes her blossom. And by the way, fellas, gentleness is not weakness. We love to be handled with care. It'd be nice if we had a little sign on our back. Handle with care. Fragile. I don't mean fragile physically. We'll outlive you, but 1 Peter 3:7 tells a man to live considerately with his wife. Another translation of that says, according to knowledge. Do you know your wife? I know men who know more about the mysterious workings under the hood of a car. Or they could recite the basketball scores or the baseball scores or the football scores. They don't have a clue about what makes their wife run. And I think that's why the scripture says back in Ephesians that a man is to nourish his wife. Oh, wow, guys, you can really put it together with your honey if you learn what nourishes her. You may know what makes your garden grow. What makes your wife grow? Women need to be cherished and nourished. You need to know her moods. You need to learn this marvelous truth that when you ask her, honey, what's wrong? And she says, nothing. That it's really not true. And you have to learn whether your wife is the kind who wants you to probe or be left alone. Or maybe this time she does and next time she won't. You see, never be guilty of saying, I cannot. That was a guilty laughter, wasn't it? Never be guilty of saying, I cannot understand women. You don't have to understand women. Just one. Yours. And your daughters, as long as they're home. And then bestow honor. Wow, that's good for mileage. Proverbs 31:28 says, her children rise up and call her blessed, and her husband also, and he praises her. And I like the way that even says what he said. Can you imagine, gals, having your husband say to you, you know, a lot of women have done well, but honey, you know, you surpass them all. And a man who stays sensitive to his wife and alert to her needs can use her strong points in their marriage to make it the richer. A wife can know her strong points. She may be deceived on some, but she can add a tremendous amount. And if you read Proverbs 31, you recognize that the scripture at the very end of that, I always used to end with, beauty is deceitful and favor. See, favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. But it goes on from there, and it says, let her works praise her. Give her the fruit of her hand. Let a woman's strong point help build in your marriage. Okay, wives, in knowing differences between what we should do in helping to meet our hubby's needs, we're exhorted to be subject to our husbands in everything. A man is to be the head of the relationship. And you know why he is? Because he's responsible to God for you, for your family. He must answer to God for you. And he cannot answer if you're trying to take the headship away. There cannot be two heads in any business. It just doesn't work. And so God has given the man the ultimate responsibility, and we must give to them our allegiance, our support. And then she's to respect her husband. Again, in Proverbs 31, it says that the heart of her husband safely trusts in her, and she will do him good all the days of her life. Interesting, isn't it? Women who outlive their husbands still have a responsibility to give respect to that man. And it's interesting that in being submissive and giving respect, often women, I think we fail to recognize that our husband's ego needs to be supported. Sometimes they come on like gangbusters, and you can't believe they ever had an ego need, but they have a very easily bruised ego often in the business world and get bashed about, and maybe number 10 man on a list of 11. And it does a lot to come home and know that in the home, you're responsible, and that your leadership is respected. First Peter tells a wife to be submissive and to win him by her life, by an inside kind of a nature that is a hidden person of the heart. Now that tells us something, that it's not to be by nagging. God does not waste words. You know, the Bible doesn't have a whole lot of words, considering all the wisdom that God could have given us. And when God spends 3 separate verses on telling him, letting a wife learn, you know, it's better for a man if he lived up on a corner of a housetop than down in the house of the nagging woman. Or how about out in the wilderness? Or how about living with a wife that's contentious is like living with a drippy faucet? That kind of gets to you, doesn't it? So that nagging is devastating to any marriage. And then Titus tells the older women in Titus 2, 3 through 5, that they're to teach the younger. They're to teach them to love their husbands. Wives, do you know how to love your honey? So often we want to be loved, and we fail to recognize that that's what older women are to teach younger, how to love their wife, their husbands, how to love their children, how to be keepers at home. And today in our mobile society that moves around so much, and there are so few homes where there are several generations close enough by that you can learn from, we make tremendous demands on our husbands, where we could be getting advice from women who would listen and have some suggestions for us, rather than putting all that pressure pot of letting our husbands feel that they must meet every single solitary question that we have. And Ephesians 5:21 sums it all up, to be subject one to another. Marriage isn't made up of my going 50% of the way and Elvin going 50% of the way. It's a giving relationship. It means we give unqualifiedly of ourselves. I was impressed with 1 Corinthians 7 in a new way in preparing for our time with you. Paul cautions that people should consider whether or not they should remain single in order to serve God if that's the calling for which he has given them. And he said the reason they must consider it is because when a man is married, he must consider how to please his wife. And a wife, when she is married, must consider how to please her husband. And have you not discovered that in marriages that you've observed, that people who are not intent upon pleasing one another, that the reason they're not is because they're intent upon pleasing themselves. And a marriage that does not have couples subject to one another, eager to please, hungry to help each other, is in trouble.
A couple of other things I'd like to mention before we go on. On Mother's Day, I got a card from our oldest daughter and said, "Dear Father, congratulations on Mother's Day." And I opened it inside and said, "For the wonderful choice you made." Well, that's really true, you know. It's a wise man who chooses the right wife. And if a guy complains about his wife, all he's doing is reflecting on his own intelligence. So the same way, it's a wise man who knows how to utilize the strengths of his wife. I know fellows who are always in financial trouble in their money situation at home. finances. And here's a gal who could really do it beautifully and control it, but never, I'm the head of the home. He's just proving how unintelligent he is. Because if he were intelligent, he'd utilize that tremendous resource he has. And as a wise man, he utilizes the skills and abilities of his mate. Now we'd like to talk a little about the pizzazz end of what we've been talking about. The acceptance and the knowledge. Actually, one of the things that enters in is when I feel completely acceptable in the sight of my mate, it really adds a dimension to our marriage. If I feel that she's rejecting me for some reason, it kind of takes the zip out. I'm insecure, and I'm sure she feels the same way. So when we have this acceptability, it adds pizzazz to our marriage. Another thing that adds pizzazz is when we are able to achieve our goals. And often those will be common goals, things that we together strive for. This health club we go to, the husband and wife have a good marriage going for them. Now, it could be improved, but it's coming along and it's doing well. But one of the reasons for it is even the health club, they're involved in it together, and that objective of seeing it succeed is happening. And it really adds a dimension to their marriage, just being able to succeed together in a goal. And they do other things together, but they also make sure that one another succeed and have this chance to succeed. So there's an inner delight and joy, fulfillment in the achievement of objectives. And what it also does is when you have this type of acceptability, it makes even the mundane things, there's breakfast and so there's dishes and there's lunch and there's dishes and, there's dinner and there's dishes, or, well, here it is Saturday and mow the lawn again, another Saturday and mow the lawn. Because you are somebody and you're finding fulfillment, it makes those things really have a place of where you enjoy doing them because your life together is growing and you find acceptability in doing those things. Now, in that, we also realize that some of these things could become mundane if we let them. But we don't allow them to do that by building our marriage. And in that, we want to make unpredictability a part of pizzazz. I think somebody mentioned that. So the time comes when, the husband calls up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and said, "Honey, you've started dinner. Cancel the plans right now because I'd love for you to go out with a man who's madly in love with you. Me. Yeah. Would you go out with me tonight for dinner?"
Yeah. Me.
You.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And you get out of the mundane. Maybe sometime the wife will gather the kids and say, "Hey, let's surprise your dad. Let's have the lawn mowed this week so we won't have to do it on Saturday." Or the husband could come in and say, "Honey, you've got dinner almost ready, I can tell." He comes home from work and says, "I've got something I'd like you to do. I'd like you to go in the front room and sit down. I've got the paper ready for you, and I'm going to fix some Diet Pepsi for you," and let's encourage her on her way. But I'm taking over right now, and from now on, you can just relax the rest of the evening. I'll do the dishes. Now, it's very important when you do that, fellows, to make sure you have smelling salts handy. But anyhow. Yeah. So even in these mundane things, you can make life exciting by making them different. And don't be predictable. You'll be unpredictable. The only area that we want predictability is in moral excellence. When it comes to moral excellence and character behavior, there we want to be predictable.
We struggled a little bit about how to talk about pizzazz. We had a lot of fun this week. Ron, we really compliment you on the title. We have not scrambled so much. We get titles that are like Building a Successful Marriage. Now, that's solid, steady. You can do something with that. But what do you do when someone sends you this thing, how to put pizzazz in your marriage? We've had so much fun the last couple of weeks. We've taken interviews with people. Now, you stop a minute and do what we did. We tried to think, first of all, how many people do we know that have pizzazz, besides us, of course? And do you know we could put them on one hand? And it got kind of frightening. We were going to, I stopped a couple in the motel last night. Thought it'd just take a straight off the cuff, but they weren't married. So I changed a little bit of the plan. And today as we were leaving the motel, he said, he had come by and he said, "Hey, doing your homework?" It was last night. I was sitting out in the lobby and praying over some of this. And I said, "Well, actually, no." And I thought, hey, marvelous opportunity to witness. Told him that we were talking today at a church, told him where it was in case he wanted to come. about how to put pizzazz in your marriage. He said, hey, how do you? I said, well, have you got an hour? Kidding. And he said, no, 2 minutes. And then I said, are you married? And I thought, of course he'd say yes. And he said, no. Well, by the time I'd recovered, they'd already gone on by. And today they came back by, and they said, hey, how'd it go? I said, great. But you know, my heart really went out to them. And the hurt look in that girl's eyes. You see, she doesn't have a marriage to put pizzazz in. Maybe she's got pizzazz, but no marriage. One of the things we talked about with people, and we asked various couples, were some of the things you've talked about, doing things that surprise one another. And Elvin was at a dinner with a friend of his the other night and invited guests to a Christian businessman's dinner. And this fellow looked across the room in a mirror, looked in a mirror across the room, and his wife was there playing the piano for the soloist. They had talked on the phone that day about their plans for the evening and so forth. She just neglected to tell him that she would be at the same dinner. She said it was worth the whole thing to see his look when he looked across the room and the double take that he did, that she didn't tell him a thing. Just kept him surprised. And they dumped Elvin out of the door very quickly when they got back home and were taking off, just delighted at that surprise for one another. And another fun thing we heard about was a billboard in Los Angeles that a fellow hired. Oh, wives, this just gets to you. And he put up in the front, I want the whole world to know that I love Phyllis. She's my wife, and thank you for 10 wonderful years. It must have cost the guy a mint. But I bet he's still getting mileage out of that thing. Another one that Elvin thought up and was supposing, I guess it actually happened with the man who said to the little child, go whisper in Mommy's ear that Daddy thinks she's the greatest. That's pizzazz. Spontaneity. So we decided we couldn't tell you too much. It'll kill it. Because guys, don't ever do any of the things we've talked about today.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
Well, I mean the exact explicit one. A wife will think, mm-hmm, well, they said that, right? And dullness sets in a marriage when you don't have any interest or spark or creativity is neglected. You take each other for granted.
Yeah, let me give you an example. One of these couples we're interviewing, Joyce was talking with the wife, and I said, well, you know, it's kind of doing the unexpected. We were at a conference a few weeks ago, and the last session was getting started, and I leaned over to my husband and said,
no, wait a minute. You better tell them where they were the whole weekend.
But it was a Christian conference.
But they were in separate rooms. If you don't tell them that, it's all over.
Well, it would work the other way, too. But she leaned over to him and said, I can hardly wait to get home in bed with you. Well, he didn't hear the rest of the conference, you know. But she said, you know, that really added pizzazz to our marriage.
Mm-hmm. Women should be very good at pizzazz because most of us enjoy creativity of one kind or another. And I think we have to be very careful not to expect to be put on a pedestal and the man do all the creative things. So it's working at it, and as Elvin has suggested, there's such a tendency to get slipshod, comfortable, lazy. But life is made up of a lot of routine. I enjoy this quote by Chesterton. That dear, dreamy old bachelor notion, the notion that the unity of marriage, the being of one flesh, has something to do with being perfectly happy and perfectly good, or even with being perfectly and continuously affectionate. I tell you, an ordinary honest man is part of his wife even when he wishes he wasn't. I tell you, an ordinary good woman is part of her husband even when she wishes him at the bottom of the sea. I tell you that whether two people are for the moment friendly or angry, happy or unhappy, the thing marches on. That great four-footed thing, the quadruped of the home. So there's excitement, but also routine.
Now, let's stand for just about a minute, give you a chance, a little warm, before we finish up here.
The second major area that we'd like to talk about is communication. I don't know why Elvin asked me to start it off. Somehow, this tremendous area of communication. Now, you understand, of course, that passing of information and communication are not necessarily the same thing. You heard about the little boy in kindergarten, the first day of school, and the teacher said to the class, now, if any of you have to go to the bathroom, raise your hand. And this little puzzled Johnny looked up and said, but teacher, what good would that do? See, there was information, but not communication. Sometime the it takes a while, you know, it takes a while to get that.
Communication.
The visible also may not be the factual. I read of the man who went in the supermarket and left his car, obviously, in the lot. When he came back in, there was this enormous dent in the fender, scraped all along one side. Terrible damage. And he was very relieved to see a note under the windshield wiper. So he went over and picked it up and read, "There are at least 16 people watching me as I write this. They think I am giving you my name and address. I am not." And no signature. You see, people observed something, but they didn't catch the facts. Now, communication touches every area of our lives. You cannot not communicate. And happily married couples have some of the same problem areas, potential problem areas, as unhappily married people. But the difference can be is that they've learned to communicate about them. Elvin suggested before that we're changing, that just being a person implies that we're a person in process. We don't have a real self sort of hidden away that's a little fully formed core, and then we haul it out, and there's my real self, as you may now look at, if I choose to reveal. No, I'm changing. There's a difference today than yesterday. We don't even hold baseball players accountable for yesterday's batting average. We look today to see if Hank Aaron got one of the last 30 yet to go. You can tell I've been married to a sportsman for 27 years. And we don't want him to get it this night now because they're playing the Dodgers. George Bernard Shaw said, "The only sensible person is my tailor. He takes my measurements anew every time he sees me, while the rest go on with their old measurements and expect them to fit me." And we can do that in marriage. Now, we communicate verbally, but we communicate non-verbally. We communicate through the five senses, do we not? Through the sight. Our appearance communicates something. We communicate through touch. A soft, just a squeeze. Or a pulling away of the hand. We communicate as we hear music. Do you sing in your house? Is there a happy sound? The tone of voice communicates. Silence speaks volumes. Even our sense of smell. I delight in having Saturdays when everybody's home, a baking day. It just smells like home. Food, perfume, all of these things, B.O. It all communicates.
Yeah, it's like the fellow said, I can't remember your face, but your breath is familiar.
Oh, terrible. We communicate through taste, our cooking and... Now, remember as we talked about that second stage, communication can become a problem when couples don't work at it. And marriage is not so much marrying the right person as being the right person. And problems arise and bad habits begin to form sometimes. And take a look at a few and see if maybe you ought to polish up some things in your marriage on communication. It's such an enormous subject, you could take the whole time on it. But say diffused attention. There are a lot of things that call for your attention in a given day. And sometimes when partners get together, they're so tired of the bombardment of noise, and they're so used to tuning out things that without thinking, Dad can sit and read the paper and just tune her out. It's so aggravating to be talking to someone and have them say, I hear you, and they're still reading. I didn't miss a word you said. And the awful thing is they repeat it back. But you don't feel like they're listening. So you have to choose to listen. You don't have busy signals. Another thing we can do is that we want to speak, not listen. To listen is to learn. I think of Mary and Martha. Mary chose the better part, to sit at the feet of Jesus. And speaking is a form of self-assertion, getting my point across. And yet Jesus said, he that have ears to hear, let him hear. And we have to remember that feelings ride piggyback on words. And if you're not listening with both ears and the ear of the heart, you can miss what's being said in feelings. Fellows, if a wife has to say, do you think my hair's all right? Or do you think I look as old as so-and-so if you go to the class reunion? The words are not just there. There's feeling, something coming across that needs to be handled. When we communicate, we listen to people for their words, but we wait sometimes for feelings to surface. Do you do that? Children pick it up quickly. They learn quickly the difference between what you've said and what you're conveying. Then assuming that the other person is, what the other person will say. All right, I know what you're going to say. I just know what you're going to say. Our thoughts, too, can race ahead. We can listen faster than we can hear, so we tune out at a given point. Excessive talking. Got to be a reason for that somewhere. Putting down each other. Or not really understanding, conveying. The couple who went to the marriage counselor, and he said, you know, in the 6 years we've been married, we've never agreed on anything. And she said, it's been 7 years, dear. Communication will diminish whenever the need to conceal from the other becomes stronger than the need to have this oneness. So if you're not communicating, and communicating well, figure out why.
I'd just like to give you four guidelines for effective communications as they appear in the Scriptures. I personally feel one of the most powerful sections in the Bible on family, marriage, relationships is Ephesians 4:15 through Ephesians 6:4. But Ephesians 4:15 gives a couple of basic things that we need to work on, and that says that we're to speak the truth in love. And so the thing that we need to work on is to be sure that we do tell the truth, but we do it lovingly. We speak the truth in love. It ties in with the second scripture, Ephesians 4:26 and 27, which says, when you're angry, don't sin. And if I were to put that in the Smith translation, it would be, when you're angry, keep your mouth shut. Because when we're angry, the way we sin the most often is by what we say. Saw a sign the other day says, the most difficult thing to explain is the thing you shouldn't have said to begin with. I'm sure Watergate case reveals that, doesn't it? But that's really true. So when you're angry, keep your mouth shut. But if you do say something, and when you're angry, don't let the sun go up on your wrath. It's another principle. You've got to make the thing right, or you're going to be allowing Satan a foothold, as Phillips puts that. He drives a wedge in, and until it's made right, you drift apart. Ephesians 4:29 says, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace to the hearers. As Joyce has said before, you never say anything that cuts the other person down. You never make your mate the butt of a joke. You never ridicule them. You never belittle them, particularly in public. Should be never, but particularly in public. Only say those things that edify. And then Ephesians 4:32, a verse you memorized in Sunday school. You'll be kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. Learn to say, I'm sorry. You'll go and ask forgiveness. The Bible is quite plain about it. Communicate. I don't know about you fellows, but it's hard for me. In fact, it's taken many years for me to be able to come to Joyce and ask for forgiveness. To admit I'm wrong, if I ever were. But that's part of the problem. But to come and apologize and ask, not just to come and say I'm sorry, but to name it. Say, honey, I did such and such. I was wrong. Will you forgive me? To do that. Part of communication. Well, in communication, of course, pizzazz really enters in there because there are a lot of ways we can use communication in its various ways to add pizzazz. You know, you come home at night from work and your wife's had the kids all day and she's kind of bedraggled and worn out, and she looks at it and you think, kind of blah. But if you come home and, boy, she got her hair all done up and she really looks sharp and dressed up, and you think, wow, she wants me to come home. She loves me. Or you could take the other end of the day. You know, this guy goes off to the office and he leaves his wife in pin curls and in a bedraggled dressing gown and goes to the office where these secretaries come in, you all alert, you know, quite a comparison. Yeah, you know, that's communication, but it's also the things that put pizzazz into this area of communication marriage. Or it can be the calling up, or let me give you another one. You send a telegram to the world's greatest wife. Have I told you lately that I love you? How fortunate I am that you married me. You could have married anybody, but you married me. Thanks for that. I love you. And sign your name. You know, a lot of things that could be done in the area of communication. Take a little imagination and take some effort. Take some time. So we can really utilize the area of communication for pizzazz.
We didn't want to get into this too much so you can have your own creativity. But remembering special dates is so important. Remembering birthdays and anniversaries. You may have been raised in a home, one of you, where they never remembered dates. But you can get around that easily. I just keep on Elvin's calendar every date that I want remembered. And then put ahead of it only 10 more shopping days until whatever. And
that's interesting because I've never forgotten one. But that helps anyhow.
And then having dates together after you're married. It's so important to keep romance. And with some creativity about it. Elvin and I realized as we were preparing that one of the things we've slipped into, we enjoy things together, but I've seen about as many Dodger games this year as I could think of other things than the Dodger game. you can slip into just habit things. If we're going to go out, we'll go to a movie. Some people do that. That's all they do. Some people do one thing. Get some creativity and think into it. You see, if you forget special anniversaries, we're put together like this. If I forget Elvin's birthday, say, he would think, hey, she forgot my birthday. If he forgets my birthday, I think, hey, he forgot me. So these are all part of Elvin writes poetry. Whatever is your thing, whatever you can do, maybe you're good with your hands, you could make something, create something. I think one of the neat things since we've been here to hear of Betty working and buying something special for Ron that's really been utilitarian but great. Those are the kind of things, a special project like that that you can do that shows extra pizzazz that makes a marriage special.
Actually, the thing that spoke to me when Joyce wrote on my calendar these special dates was not that I would forget, because I don't think I ever have forgotten a special date. But what got to me was she thinks enough of me that she wants to make sure that I know that date's coming up so we can be together. And so that really communicated love to me. So I kind of put a little zip in it. Well, and the final thing we want to go to in these final minutes is something we should spend a lot more time on, and that's consideration and sex. Now, actually, these fit very well together because the greatest area in which consideration can be demonstrated is in the area of sex. Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4 give a key to this, and most of you probably memorize them. It says, look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. Your desire is to show consideration, to take the place the other person is and find out how you can meet their needs in that particular situation of life. And I was reading a little deal that really showed this attitude of concern or consideration for a mate's needs, and it's centered around consideration and sex. It says, a husband and wife who are much in love will be as anxious to satisfy one another as to be satisfied. Hence, they will bring to each of their intimate encounters a desire to make the union mutually gratifying. On those occasions when one feels need and the other not, true lovers will either be patient and desist in the face of mate's unreadiness, or the one who feels no particular need will gladly and willingly yield to embrace that the need of the other may be fulfilled. If, on the other hand, one mate or the other is abnormally self-centered and thinks only of his or her own need or lack of need, then sexual harmony is certain to be destroyed. For love cannot thrive in a climate where a person is turned into a thing to be used for for selfish gratification. Nor can it flourish in an atmosphere where one who feels no need often resists the advances of the other whose desire is normal. Consideration in marriage. Ephesians 4:2 is a tremendous verse to memorize from the Living Bible. If I can just remember how it goes, I'll think of it in a minute and tell you what it says. But it talks about this realm of being considerate of one another and thinking about how you can actually meet the needs of others and overlooking one another's faults because of your love. It says, be humble and gentle. Be patient with one another, making allowance for one another's faults because of your love. That's consideration. I think that 1 Corinthians 7, 3 through 5, which are talking specifically about meeting the sexual needs of one another, center around the area of not only responsibility, but of consideration. So we really need to develop these right attitudes when it comes to really meeting one another's needs in every area of life, showing consideration, particularly in sex. Someone has wisely said that a wife seemingly has three basic needs. One is the need to be loved, needed, and accepted. The second is she needs manliness in her mate, which will allow her to lean on him. A third, she needs an understanding of her varying moods. I was recently reading an article in Family Circle, which is really tremendous. It's called How American Wives Respond to Sex and Marriage. And they have taken a survey all across the country impartially, wide variety of life situations. And here are the things that really came out in this. It says, to most American wives, the magic that holds a marriage together and makes it happy is not sex per se, but thoughtfulness and consideration. Most tend to be in agreement that marital sex have to have its mental as well as its physical side. As they've generally pointed out, the sex relationship becomes far more secure and better when it's built on mutual understanding and fulfillment in every area of life. Mutual consideration.
As we talked about the differences before in male and female, we felt this was one that's really key for women to know. In all of our lives, and men to know, there seems to be this whole thing of objectivity and subjectivity of the male and the female. And, of course, that carries over into our physical relationship as well. Sex has deeper meanings to a wife than to a man, normally. In the male, the sex drive is more surface, a more physical thing, where with a female, as Elvin has just suggested, it's an all-inclusive relationship that takes in much more than just the act itself. It's deeper, and it's a matter of the whole person. A man is more easily aroused than a woman, and very often would require more frequent intercourse than his wife. Where with the female, the stirrings are deeper. It takes longer for desire to be aroused. In most men would need sex more often, but if recognizing that for a woman, that the how-to is more important than how often. So there should be experiment and variety for that individual, your needs, your particular needs. And hubbies, never forget that she's a woman. She needs your manliness, but she needs never to be forgotten that she's a woman. Don't offend. Some wives are offended by particular language. Learn what your wife likes that turns her on, but that which offends her. And sex, guys, should begin maybe at breakfast. Not with the act, perhaps, but a love pat. Many wives who feel that if there's a pat or a verbal expressions of love, it's only because it's about time for bed, and it doesn't really warm the heart. Be a wise lover. Warm her up with words first, and don't expect that the result will be the same every time. Most wives are very happy to meet the frequent needs of their husband without expecting stars and drum rolls and the whole thing every time. She's content to make her man happy.
One of the things that enters into this is a knowledge of the difference between male and female that Joyce has referred to. And someone has said that when God made male and female, he basically made the man with a surface drive, because apart from that, without the pressing surface drive, many men might never have married. And he made woman with a drive that had to be built up, a subsurface drive, because if he hadn't done that, the world would have been one mad sex orgy. And with the problems we have already with it, why, we can understand that. I think also another realization in these drives is that you can have a difference of opinion, and to a man, the way to make up is to go to bed. To a woman, that's reprehensible. You know, how could you possibly want to make love when there's anything between you? And so you need to recognize that those basic character personality differences do exist. And so it's a wise man who realizes that he should make up before he ever makes amorous advances. Whereas it may be a wise woman who realizes if that doesn't happen, that to the man this is saying, okay, I'm sorry, and then this will patch things up. So it's a two-way street of learning each other and learning together. Now in this pizzazz area, obviously the key in your sex life is probably two things. It's the knowing your mate. Knowing those things which please them, which don't please them. Those things which turn them on and turn them off. And imagination. You let your imagination run rampant. It may be the husband squeezing his pennies and calling up his wife and saying, hey, would you go out with me on a date? I made arrangements where we've got a babysitter to take care of the kids this weekend, and we're going to go off to San Francisco for the weekend, you know. Wow! I just want to be together with you. Well, you know, women like that type of thing. But imagination. And with that, taking the time to really think through, to plan. But one of the reasons for the imagination is if you come along, and as we mentioned previously, if you were to do some of these things we talked about, or if you were to read a manual on sex in marriage, and it says, now you do this, and do this, and do this, if you go along that sequence with your wife, and she's read the same books, you think, oh, now he's on paragraph 2 of page 34, you know. No good, you know.
There's another thing in the spontaneity, is the unpredictable. I think it's very difficult for women who anticipate that all of their physical encounters will always be the same way. So predictable that it's difficult to be turned on, because you know exactly what's coming and what's going to happen. So these are all needs. One of the things that we felt was a wise investment is the lingerie fund. Fellows, if you've not discovered the joy of putting in pennies, dimes, nickels, quarters, dollars, however soon you'd like to have the event come that she can shop, a lingerie fund is a marvelous investment.
Amen. Well, we have run out of time. In fact, we run over time. We run into your coffee time, so please forgive us for that. And Ron?